I consider it a great privilege to be able to come and talk to you, be invited to come and speak to an audience that I always stand in awe of, as I do those who are connected with our great educational institutions, not only because they are learned, but because of the responsibility which they have and the great opportunity which they have to do those things which our country is in great need of at the present time. Perhaps I can only tell you sincerely how I appreciate this by telling you a story that I came to appreciate more after I came back from this experience of being away for 2 years in Europe, and was rather disillusioned to find out that many of my friends did not even know that I had been away. It's always a very humbling experience, and even more so when they do recognize you, sometimes with a delayed reaction as they pass you on the street and say a casual hello the first time, and after they've taken four or five steps, their mental processes finally catch up with the fact that I haven't seen that fellow for 2 years, and I've been in Europe, so they turn around and shout the second greeting. But after that, they have very little interest, in most cases, in asking you what you did while you were away. They're not interested in your operation, and you're dying to tell them about it. So when I get an invitation to come to a group like this, I do appreciate it. This story, I think you may enjoy too, about the young fellow who left his small town and went to the big city to make his fortune. And after 7 years of very hard, close work in which he didn't take a vacation, he gradually moved up to become president of his company. And at that time, he developed a nostalgia to go back to the old hometown and see how it had gotten along without him during these 7 years. And as the train pulled into the station, his face rather flushed in anticipation of the warm greetings and the congratulations he would receive from his fellow townsmen. And so you can imagine the feeling that he had when he stepped down on the train onto the station platform, and there wasn't a familiar face there on the platform to greet him. And he looked in vain among the taxi cab drivers and the hotel porters, but not a single person did he know. Well, he said to himself, "Old Zeke in the baggage room will remember me." And so he picked up his grip and walked down into the station, into the baggage room, and there was old Zeke, and he greeted him, and Zeke turned around and recognized his old friend, and he says, "Hello, Joe, are you going away?" If the world were at peace today, I would put in my application first for the job as chief of the ECA mission in Greece, which I occupied for a year, and if that were filled, I would put in the application for a position of chief of the ECA mission in Belgium, which I also occupied for a year. Many of you will be surprised that Greece is my first choice. Any one of you who happen to have the good fortune to have served any length of time in Greece or have known anybody who has been there will find that most Americans who have been there want to go back. It's a great country, and sometime I'd like to have the opportunity to spend an hour or two just talking about Greece. I could have stayed in Greece if I'd wanted to accept the situation as it was and really ride along, but I was not happy about that because I did not feel that we were succeeding in Greece. I asked to be transferred as a result to Belgium, and I stayed there for a year in the kind of a job that would make your mouths water. In case you have any impression that at least the top people in our foreign service are underpaid, let me tell you that you were paying me a salary while I was over there of $17,500 a year. I was having a house furnished to me, and a very nice house. I had a car and a chauffeur also furnished to me. I had, we had about four servants, and three of those you also furnished to me. And I had an entertainment allowance too, as long as I had some member of the diplomatic corps or the Belgian government present at the party, well then I could expect to have the expense of the party paid for. I had access, naturally, in my position to almost anything that I wanted in the Belgian government or around the Belgian scene, the countryside, and it was a very charming life that we were able to lead under those circumstances. Just a year ago, I came back to the United States at my own expense because I was so alarmed at the way in which things were going, our failure of our foreign policy. I hoped that I could come back and get somebody stirred up to doing something about it. And I visited all those people that I thought might do something, and if I got a chance to see them, I found they were so completely occupied with other things that I made very little impression. And I went back over to Belgium and finished out my 2 years of service, Not that I was bound to 2 years of service, but it is the conventional period for which people are employed in the Foreign Service and before they are allowed home leave. And I had not employed anybody while I was in Greece, where we had one of the largest staffs in Europe, who would not agree to come and stay for 2 years, and so my conscience would not let me come home before that time had elapsed. I am back here now because I think probably there is a greater opportunity that I can do something about the great danger which this country faces by coming back and talking to you back here than there is staying over in Europe, where I seem to be powerless to do anything about it. It isn't necessary today, I think, to paint to you the picture as it exists, because we have had a great deal of discussion in the last few months, at least, of how dangerous a position we are in. All I can say is that it's worse than you think it is. When Mr. Hoover finally gets around to taking a look at this situation, it's interesting that he comes up with a conclusion that it is hopeless. I say by that it's hopeless. He says, we have no chance to do anything in Europe. We have any chance in Asia, let's pull out. I think that's back of his general approach to the program. Nobody would have believed that in 5 years, even the worst administration that we could have imagined could have fumbled everything as badly as we have had, and we could have lost the pieces completely and gotten to a position where, from being absolutely on top of the world, we are down where we say it's almost impossible for us to think of doing anything effectively in Europe or in Asia, and let's pull out and try to hold a line. Let's try to build a line and shrink in behind that and protect ourselves. The suggestion that we move back and take a defensive position, I think most of you will recognize, is an acceptance of defeat. Certainly, I can tell you from business that if you were in a competitive business and you ever stop going ahead, you start to go back. There isn't any place that you can stand still. And in the struggle for world power, it's the same thing. And whenever the United States gets to the point that all we can think of is trying to put up a Maginot Line or whatever it may be and saying we're going to try to hold that, then we are on the way out. Unless we have a program, unless we have a vitality in the things that we believe and that we are willing to support and defend, and are willing to move out with the same degree of enthusiasm or a greater degree than Russia has been moving in the last 5 years, then we must recognize that we have ceased to become at least a growing power. We are on the decline and are on the way out. I won't discuss Mr. Hoover's suggestions beyond that. I'm not that I have any fundamental disagreement with Mr. Hoover. I think he has been one of our great statesmen. He has made many wonderful suggestions in the past, wonderful speeches, and if we had followed his leadership and many other things, the country would be in much better shape today. I think I do recognize that at his age, it is not unnatural that some of the reactions which he has are not those of younger men who are more vigorous and are willing to fight. Mr. Taft has perhaps not gone quite as far as Mr. Hoover, but I think is just as defeatist, just as unrealistic about the situation which we find over in Europe. Mr. Dewey, who was not my first choice as Republican candidate for president, nevertheless has demonstrated that he has great ability to bring facts together, to examine the evidence and present a case. And he has done that, I think, very effectively as regards our position in the world, and stated the case why we cannot withdraw from Asia, why we cannot withdraw from Europe. Because such withdrawal ultimately means that with Europe and Asia in the hands of the Russian imperialist forces, they will move on to Africa, ultimately to South America, and Canada and ourselves might try to exist for a time, 163 million people against a communist world of 2 billion. But we could not hope to survive with all of the sources of raw materials, which we would then be denied access to, the uranium from Africa, the manganese from Africa and from Russia and from the other sources, the tin, the rubber. 64 out of the 75 critical materials we need to fight a war, we have to import all or in part. And a good share of those would then be behind the Iron Curtain and not accessible to us. The thing that is sobering, I think, is not alone the picture that he points, but the conclusion that he comes to. A conclusion, I'm reading now from an article he wrote in Collier's Magazine, the February 10th issue, entitled "The Red Tsar Moves to Conquer Us." Why is it necessary to present this picture, bleak and desperate as it is, It is necessary because if the United States continues to follow either the present disorganized and leaden pace of preparation, or if it turns coward and shrinks within itself, this nation and the whole concept of human freedom on earth are inevitably doomed to extinction. The cause of freedom can be saved, but surely this is the last call for action. It can be saved only by strong American moral leadership and a clear understanding that we are brave enough and honest enough to know that we cannot live alone in a communist world. There is still time to win. 6 months from now, it may be too late. Only the home of the brave can be the land of the free. A very fine statement, but Mr. Dewey has not gone beyond answering the ineffective, I think, realization on the part of some of the other leaders of our position, and a statement that we must go ahead in our military preparations. However, he has offered no real program that is an answer to communism, because you don't fight ideologies with guns any more than you fight ideas with subsidies. And we have not had any leadership in this country today that is discussing the real problems that we face. The only things that we might do, which ultimately might start democracy and Christianity on a crusade that could eventually embrace enough of the world that we can protect the things which we have, because we can only protect them as we extend them. Communism, as you well know, in all of its writings and its declarations and statements and its actions, is of the conviction, as near as we can understand anything, that communism and democracy and Christianity cannot exist in the same world. It's either one or the other, and they are out to eliminate us, to push us off the map. I think that's a realistic appraisal of the situation that we face. Well, here we are in the process of mobilization. I think there's no alternative, but we've got to do that. I don't think we're doing it fast enough. I think the situation is more desperate than we realize. We have been awakened, but awakened altogether too slowly, because the things which finally caused us to mobilize are facts which have been known for 2 or 3 years. We should have known even within a few months after the close of the war that Russia had given no indication that she was going to demobilize her army, that she has not ceased for 1 minute to continue to build up an effective military machine. The Germans told us at the close of the war that the Russians had the best tanks in the world. It wasn't until a year ago that our army woke up to the fact that something had to be done about that, and we now have some on the blueprint stage, and I think the first series of one style of tank are coming off which can challenge the Russian supremacy. But it has taken all this time, and we finally had to have a demonstration in Korea of our inadequacy before we awakened to the situation. But if we just go ahead on a program of mobilization, we are merely running the United States into debt at the rate of maybe $30 or $40 billion a year on an already very high debt. And if we continue that for very many years, that's all that Russia wants to do, because ultimately we will have financial collapse. And that's what she's waiting for. That's what she anticipates. And so unless we have some proposal other than mere mobilization, why, there is not going to be any hope for us. We are still on the way out. Well, we have had some suggestions, although in general people more or less recoil at the idea of a defensive war, that are taking the offensive against Russia. But we still have some people that do suggest it. Last November, talking to the Executives Club in Chicago, Kenneth DeCourcy, who is the editor of Intelligence Digest, a little publication put out over in London that makes an effort to secure confidential material from behind the Iron Curtain and give intelligence as to what our dangers are, speaking, said that the thing that we ought to do is to drop the atom bomb on the Russian oil field. He said if you once can do that, then you'll paralyze not only the Russian agricultural machinery, which is making it possible to feed the people, but you will immobilize all of their tanks and their other equipment, and that way we can put an end to this threat of the Russian imperialism.